Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, our panel of mental health experts are here to continue our conversation from last month on conspiracy theories, but also to share thoughts on cults and what is called the attention economy. With us, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. Good morning to you all.
Good morning, Mindy.
Good morning.
To say we are living in a time of information overload is an understatement. An article in the New York Times from February 10th by Charlie Wurzel about the attention economy caught our eye. And the first time I've heard this term, attention economy, a term coined by psychologist Herbert Simon, but it was this former theoretical physicist, Michael Goldhaber, who predicted this information glut that makes it harder and harder to focus our attention. He predicted this back as early in the 1980s. Mark, tell us a little bit more about what the attention economy is.
Sure. It's really a fascinating way of looking at information and really what our lives are really consist of day to day. Put simply, an economy is something where you have transactions. You transact in our usual economy, general economy, we transact money for services, for goods, et cetera. Well, an attention economy is one where attention is the mode of payment and request. So you have to realize that our attention is a limited resource. In other words, we can only pay attention to so many things, and it's pretty narrow actually to really pay attention to certain things. We can only pay attention to so many things and for a certain amount of time. So it's a limited resource, whereas, and it's also a zero sum game that if you pay attention to one thing, you're ignoring something else, you're missing out. So in order to get information, the first step is to get your attention. Information is unlimited. And it comes at us in like a fire hose in unlimited quantities, unlimited time frames. We're always exposed to information. And basically, it's all to grab our attention because you can't get a message across unless you have attention. So attention is like the is like money in a way. It's traded and we give it unconsciously. In other words, we pay attention to things without intention. It just happens. We ought to be a little bit more conscious of this factor because so much is out there trying to have our attention and competing for it. That can make a big difference in the kind of beliefs that you form and the kind of things that you learn about the world in terms of how you've spent your given daily attention quota, so to speak. So he's just pointing out how attention is runs our social interactions defines our living so much. It really brings it to the forefront. We need to pay attention to how we pay attention. So that's what he's pointing out. And it's being pointed out at a particularly relevant time right now where so much of our attention has been abused and has been misused and has been manipulated. Looking at what goes on in our social discourse through the eyes of an attention economy, I think makes sense and provides us with some enlightenment, really.
What I found really surprising was just how much this guy predicted is, you know, like in early, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, he said, the dominance of the internet, increased shamelessness in politics, terrorists co-opting social media, the rise of reality television, personal websites, oversharing, the online influence culture, and the near destruction of our ability to focus. Right. I don't think any of us had any clue. I mean, this guy really, really could see into the future. You know, it's interesting because I think, and it's happened so quickly, all of this has happened so quickly, it's hard to, but the influence of the online culture is one thing that stood out to me because I've noticed recently this, you know, they say social influencer, and I'm like, what the heck is a social influencer? Ooh. But I'm like, and that's a job, you can make money at that? And people, mostly younger people, but they do, and they really do have a huge impact on what people buy, what they wear, what they watch. You know, it's really quite amazing, and it plays into this whole, you know, attention.
Absolutely, they're collectors of clicks. Mm-hmm. The more clicks you get, the more power you have. That's the other factor. The more attention that you can garner, the more power you have. And that's just like having a lot of money. Of course, money can make things happen, but attention can also make things happen.
And it folds into the whole idea of that we're all vulnerable to the needs behind the conspiracy theories, the needs for exclusivity and having inside knowledge, like this is the best eyeliner you can get, and it's definitely only you know about it. This is how influencers work. And the idea of belonging, that you belong to Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop collective. Mm-hmm. And then also the idea of certainty, that you can always have some kind of certainty about what you're buying, what you need, what you want, because we have this influencer who says, you know, you are part of my special little group here. And so it's interesting that influencers and that kind of attention can in that way feed the need that we all have for, it's a basic need in us that has gotten exploited with the conspiracy theorists for that specialness, that belonging, and that need for certainty.
Yeah, I think it's not immediately obvious as to how this conversation about the attention economy, which I totally agree is really just so important and fundamental, how that connects with conspiracy theories, how that connects with the way in which life has changed and our culture is facing puzzles that we've never faced before. But I do think that this notion about the attention, it's upsetting, it's depressing, it's shocking. You know, we as somebody who specializes in evaluating and treating ADHD, I'm so accustomed to talking with parents and with kids about how their attention gets divvied up, and the importance of really focusing on what's important and not allowing themselves to be distracted by video games and all the things that kids spend time on. But this article, this conversation about the attention economy really turns the mirror on us as adults and how we ourselves make decisions constantly through every waking moment about what we will give our attention to.
Right.
Well, once you kind of really think about that, and any of us can think about how our own attention gets sent around like a ping pong ball, that's almost like a prelude to thinking about how people come to join these online circles and why people become sort of surrounded by conspiracy theories or any kind of theories that eventually become their whole world. So part of what, you know, we discussed or read about in preparation for this is about how certain people, or rural people, people who are disenfranchised, people who see themselves as being on the outside looking in, et cetera, how they in particular are likely to become entranced by conspiracy theories. So that's building on the attention economy to think about how people who now, of course, have access to the internet, and what is it in their life that would then make these conspiracies like QAnon so attractive, and how these conspiracy theories really explain to people and rationalize for people why their life isn't what they wish it were, or why they are justified in being angry about circumstances. It's just, it's all, I mean, it's almost, you know, too complex to even make sense of in a single conversation. Yeah. But life is sure changed.
Yeah,
it's interesting because in this article, Michael Goldhaber also said that the attempted Capitol insurrection in January was the result of thousands of influences and news outlets in an attempt to gain fortune and fame and attention, trotted out increasingly dangerous conspiracy theories on platforms optimized to amplify outrage, which kind of speaks to what you're saying, Jonathan, right there. It's yeah. And Mark, you have some thoughts on that about, you know, just even looking at the belief systems, if you will, between liberals and conservatives.
Yeah, I wanted to get this across that there really is profound difference. It can be profound differences between how conservatives process information and how liberals process information. And you can even find some roots in genetics based on the differences. It basically, there's a large body of research that shows various personality traits being quite different and various values and morals of being different. For instance, Democrats or liberals tend to value fairness and safety more than other possible values. And the way they get this is they give personality questionnaires that tease out these differences. Republicans and conservatives are much more structured. They prefer structure over other things. They prefer answers that settle the issue because they're looking for closure. And they are much more responsive and reactive to negative stimuli. They become fearful more often, more quickly, and more alarmingly than liberals do. Liberals, on the other hand, are open to new experiences, whereas conservatives are just the opposite. They tend to be. And what we're talking about, these are characteristics that come from the unconscious parts of our brains. They're just set ways of processing information that our senses bring in. Liberals are also more conscientious. Conservatives are more conscientious than liberals. They get things done because they're dedicated to their group, to their cause, stronger than liberals are. Liberals are into nuance and differences and will argue endlessly sometimes about that. And so what happens is they get disorganized. Take, for instance, the Wall Street protests of a number of years ago, pointing out the difference between the 1% and the 99%. That protest was really very disorganized, chaotic, and different people were promoting different aspects of it. That's typical liberal behavior, whereas conservatives will rally around and be more loyal to given principles that they want to promote, regardless of the facts. I'm going to say something that is going to probably shock people, but there's psychological studies showing that conservatives are more wrong about facts than liberals are, that they tend to misinterpret facts much more than liberals do. Let me explain just a little example of that. One study took things that were definitely factual. For instance, what was included in the healthcare bill that Obama put forward, his Obamacare. What was included, what wasn't. Conservatives were much more readily believing that there was going to be Medicare death penalties. They were much more believing that there was going to be a huge debt because of the provisions of the healthcare bill. They thought that Medicare was going to be cut because of the healthcare bill. Now, those things, in other words, money was taken out of Medicare to pay for this. Those things are not true. If you look at the factual writing of the bill, those things aren't there. But conservatives are more likely to believe them. That's just one example of a factual matter that is processed quite differently. The conservatives are more likely to react to something new being threatening. Liberals are more welcoming and open to something new. That makes for a whole different way of processing decision making because of the how their lower brain functions that is different, just a different propensity. And then if you,
I'm just thinking, the brain processing in these two categories, is everybody fall into one of those categories, or is there a middle ground? Are there people?
There's blending. No. That's what I was going to get to. Yeah. There has to be blending. But these are gross characteristics or tendencies and they're not, it's not a sharp demarcation. There is a blending and a gradual, but statistically, you take a group of conservatives and a group of liberals, and these are, and you're going to find differences that are significant between the way things are processed. And then,
I mean, Mark, this is certainly very incendiary talk here,
right?
To say that because it's very hard to hear what you're saying or what you're referring to without there being judgmental.
Well, exactly. You know,
so, do these papers offer any sort of explanation for how or why people with conservative attitudes would tend to be more likely to misinterpret what we see as facts? I mean, we got to go a little further here, or else we're going to get
air or something. We may have lost some people, may have changed the stations real quick in hearing this. I don't blame them the way I look at it is that this is simply a product of our evolution. There were people that were more conscientious, more organized, more driven, and would follow, more authoritarian, would follow orders. Those are the people that get things done in society. On the other side, there's more people that are open to, there's other people that are more set to be open to new experiences. And they can create, okay? So our society has evolved just like Darwinian, based on some Darwinian principles of survival of the fittest. Both of these characteristics or broad generalizations have come from evolution, in this case, of culture. And it's useful. They do both serve useful needs. So that's why listen to people who say we need a strong conservative party in this country, because we do. And to get things really done in government, we have to have characteristics of both blended and combined to move forward. And right now, like you said, Jonathan, these studies can be used in a pejorative way, negative judgmental way. They shouldn't, because these are characteristics of humanity. They're not ways of processing information is not really chosen. It's not a decision that we make to consciously and weigh the pros and cons of it. It just comes automatically. It's a gut reaction, instinctual. The best thing that we can do to deal with this is be aware of our predispositions and realize that we're more likely to, for instance, have motivated reasoning. We're motivated to reason certain ways. Whereas that's just our tendency, and we ought to be aware of it so we can get a little bit more control over it and be accepting of others who don't have the same processing setup, processing software, so to speak, that we do, or that the liberals do. You have to be open. The good news is liberals are more likely to make a difference in this than conservatives are, because liberals are open to new experience. Okay, so they're more open to ambiguity. They're more open to considering that they're wrong, and keeping an open mind. So if you want to have a intelligently designed culture, it's going to have to be largely a burden of the liberals to promote it, because they basically can understand, they can feel, they can take in information better than conservatives do, because they're actually, the studies show, conservatives use motivated reasoning more than Democrats. It's not that Democrats don't use it. It's just that the intensity, quantity of it is more relied on by conservatives than liberals.
We are talking about conspiracy theories, cults, and the attention economy, and we will talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about conspiracy theories, cults, and the attention economy with psychiatrists Mark Whaley and Jonathan Schwartz and social worker Ann Gagan. We aren't able to take phone calls this morning, but if you'd like to chime in, we'd love to see your email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I want to get back to the attention economy for a second. There's this idea that attention gives you power, right? So this can create some inequality, obviously. And when you pay attention to one thing, you're ignoring something else. I want to talk about that a little bit, that the inequality that we're creating with this attention economy.
I don't know what you mean by inequality.
Well, not everybody has, you know, everybody's scrambling for this power, right? We're all, you know, like everybody is, you know, create like these social media influencers, or you've got your YouTube channel, or you mean we have this glut of info where everyone's trying. Reality television is a great example of that. You know, you see these shows where people are going on, and really, what is their aim to win this, you know, contest, or is it to become famous? Look at all these people we have who are famous now, and you're really not sure for what. you know, it's like I always laugh at that concept of reality television, because it's anything but reality. But then I've been thinking, just looking around at, you know, what people believe to be reality, I'm like, does this idea of what you think reality should be, if you think it and say it long enough, does it become reality? I mean, reality TV just seems so far afar from what reality really is. And I just feel like, you know, if you're low income, you may not have access to some of, you know, this social media platforms and, you know, internet. And, you know, we see that inequity in some school systems, and thinking there's got to be inequity, I would think, when you're looking at, you know, garnering all this attention or even being part of that.
So Mindy, I recently became acquainted with this concept that many people have been acquainted with, I guess, for years, called SEO, search engine optimization.
Oh, I don't know that.
Yeah. Do you know what that is?
No.
Oh, well, so people pay a lot of money. I am currently paying a lot of money in order to take advantage of this, of SEO. So SEO is how you get the most eyeballs on the internet by learning what words, what phrases, what terms will get you to the top of the Google page. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, people who are knowledgeable about this, and I certainly am not, or people who are able and willing to pay others who are knowledgeable about this, can get on the first page, and preferably within the first five items listed on any Google search, by knowing what words, what phrases, even just, you know, naming a certain town there's a whole science and art to this. So I think of this because one of the points that's addressed in the articles that, you know, are now being written about all of this and the attention economy are all about how do you influence people? What does it mean to be an influencer? And how do you get to be good at influencing people? And the better you are at influencing people, in other words, you literally can pay people who will use SEO to have the most number of people like your page or like your website or like your whatever. And the more people you have, the higher you go up on the page. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole science to this. This is a huge business in the global economy. Who would have, you know, it's not something that any of us, you know, were taught in school, even graduate school. I mean, it's, but this is relevant to how ideas, how conspiracies, how groups of people are come together, and how somebody searching for something gets the attention, or I should say how an idea gets the attention of somebody who's on the internet.
Right. Now, the SEO is a method of bartering for attention. It's a proven method, statistically based, I imagine, based on software analysis. You're trying to get attention. And that, I think that's also why reality TV is so popular. It's attention grabbing.
Yeah. People also, I think it's really important to look at how, what a master our last president was at attention grabbing. He was a master, and right, maybe because he'd been in the reality TV business prior to the presidency, he always left you with a shock, a surprise, we'll see. So you're always coming in. I mean, this is a technique to say, what's he going to do tomorrow? What's he going to do next week? What's going to happen here? We were addicted. I mean, all of us were addicted to that level of attention grabbing and wanting to know and being actually fearful that if I don't pay attention to what this individual is doing, something bad's going to happen to me. And frankly, it's a personal opinion, a lot of bad things did happen. Sure. But it was always, it wasn't even content. It was getting that attention. He was a master at it.
Yeah.
And also a master at serving the unmet needs of many disenfranchised individuals that links it all into how powerful he became and how he became the savior of folks who had these various conspiracy ideas that he could feed into by knowing how to keep their attention.
That's right. Yeah, actually, you're in agreement with President Biden. He said the same thing last night on the town hall. He said, yay, for the past 4 years, our attention has been monopolized by Trump. I don't want to be a president like that, he said. I want to be a president for the people, not make everything about me. You know, he's more focused on substance than appearance, which was Trump's way of gathering attention, getting attention. And he got a huge amount of power based on it and still has it. It's going to be, it remains to be seen how he's going to keep it if it's going to persist.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a real contest about that.
We're looking at these, like, you know, was it SEO? Did you call it China? All these different ways where, you know, like I said, everybody's trying to get that bit of it because there's so much out there for us to look at. You know, you go on, you know, Facebook, there's always these like, are you a child of the 80s? Take this quiz. And, you know, there's all like these great headlines where they all clickbait to get you to click on for, you know, I guess their advertisers, the more clicks you get, the, you know, the more money you make. And half the time, if you do click on it, you're like, wait a minute, this makes no sense to whatever the headline was, or the photo is not even part of whatever you're looking at. And even like so advertising, I mean, our, you know, advertisers, of course, have always been, you know, fighting for the audience and the attention. And some of the ads we have now, they're really not about information. they're about grabbing your attention. And you think of like the Geico ads or the Old Spice or the one that, oh, the Progressive, the Flow. It's like those things are like just so bad. It's like, what are they even talking about, right? But it's get your attention, and that's the whole point, right?
Exactly. You know, I was looking or remembering the rioters and watching them in the in their destructive mob action. I think one of the ingredients was motivating them was for attention, and they were, I think, kind of drunk on the attention they were getting, and then of course they were mobilizing around that and coming together in agreement with their goal of disruption. But I think one of the things that these were, again, we're talking about people that otherwise may have been disenfranchised. Also others that I think the people in those riots were subject to authoritarianism. They were more willing to accept the authoritarian and the social dominance kind of way of thinking. Certainly white supremacy is an extreme example of social dominance, but that also is a personality trait. Conservatives, again, are more likely to accept social dominance kind of structures, whereas liberals are not. Liberals are more individualistic, and that's why it's getting liberals together to do something is like herding cats. It's frustrating. But conservatives aren't necessarily like that. They can really unite around slogans, around some simple explanations, whereas liberals don't accept that. They just aren't oriented to do that.
Well, we are talking about conspiracy theories, cults, and the attention economy. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about conspiracy theories, cults, and the attention economy. With us this morning are psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, and social worker Ann Gagan. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. One of the things we just sort of touched upon are cults. And I'm wondering, in this time of all of this, you know, information glut as we're talking about and attention economy, cults have always been around. They're nothing new. But is this a type of environment that it is easier for cults to attract people? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, anytime there's more uncertainty and fear, yes. When things are unpredictable, yes. And we're in a time when things are very unpredictable, even your own life with the COVID pandemic, your own job, so many things are unpredictable. So yes, cults have a strong magnet because they provide a way of believing that answers all questions. And you don't have to worry about it. You can be, in some ways, childlike. So it has a great, great appeal.
I also believe, and this has been a, there aren't too many things that I've believed in over decades, but one of the things that I believe strongly is that the fundamental human wish for a sense of community, a sense of family, a sense of network has been constantly threatened just by the nature of the global village, of how less frequently families stay together in the same geographical area. I think that as our children and our grandchildren live many, many miles away from us, all of us search to have a stronger bond with others, a sense of, again, a sense to build and rebuild a sense of community, which has become more difficult. And yet social media and the internet have made it possible to find a community out there, whether you are, a teenager who believes they were born into the wrong gender and is searching for a sense of community by identifying others. Here's a great example of what a wonderful asset the internet and social media have been for people who feel isolated and alone. We also have seen that when it comes to organizations like QAnon, et cetera, that's also a way for things to grow and spiral very, very quickly because mm-hmm. social media affords that opportunity.
That's right. Yeah. When you talk about sense of family, I'm thinking gangs have done that for decades, right? I mean, that gangs bring in younger members by, you know, we're your family, right? And that's that same side of idea. And just looking at, you know, you mentioned QAnon, and I'm just thinking, you know, first you see someone who gets involved in a cult, whatever that cult may be, and you think, how could they not see this? So what is it that helps form our beliefs that we could be taken in, if you will, and signs that, you know, a lot of times when people get out of a cult, they go, I didn't even realize I was into a cult until they were in pretty deep. So right. What are your thoughts on that?
I think one thing that's relevant, at least in considering that that phenomenon, is a feeling of knowing, which is an unconscious feeling. It's just like a sensation. But we all are subject to it. We have a feeling of knowing something. And that's rewarding. Because once you feel you know something, you've reduced general uncertainty of life. And life is just a constant contest of predicting what's going to occur, and especially when it has to do with safety. So if you have a feeling of knowing and you have other people that are echoing it at your elbow, you feel safe, you feel secure. And that's what cults provide. That's what Trump followers get in their devotion to him. They have a feeling.
Go ahead, Mark. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to finish up. They have a feeling of knowing that what they're doing is right and everything else is not. That's satisfying and addictive, too.
There's also the huge emotional bond. And I think that's where it becomes facts don't really matter. The emotional attachment. I mean, we have an incredible example with the last administration, and I think this is applicable to any cult. You get involved, you attach to that person. They're filling a deep emotional need, unmet need. And you think of all the folks, and again, it's just an example of walking around with paraphernalia, the red hat. You're taking on aspects of that leader, of those ideas, and it's very emotional. And you, that's why facts don't matter, because there's an attachment. We are connected in a very special way. And then we're connected as a group in a very special way. And we're connected with each other in a very special way. And it makes me feel like I'm okay. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel like I belong. It makes me feel like I've got something going in my life that maybe other people don't. So I think that when you recognize the emotional attachment, that's where facts, they really don't matter.
It's funny, because that was one of the questions I was going to ask, is this whole trend of rejection of truth. And it isn't, we aren't talking just politics. There's, you know, I think it kind of goes along with this glut of information, right? You can find the truth you're seeking, whether it's the actual truth as in factual or not, right? So that's another trend that we're seeing that's a little disturbing, is this rejection of truth.
Because that rejection strengthens our social bond mm-hmm. with others, like Anne was saying. That's what it... that's how it works and how it gets you to feel more secure and better about yourself, because you're getting attention, actually. Go back to that again. People are paying attention to you. The people that are paying attention to you are the people that are in your same group, same cult, same tribe. That is what drives us. In other words, attention. We're driven to seek attention more than we're driven to seek truth.
There's an interesting study of the people who have so far been arrested as a result of the riots at the Capitol, And one of the findings was that a very high percentage of the people who've been arrested have had a lot of financial reversals over the course of their life, and in particular, you know, over the course of the last 5 or 10 years. I think something like 40 or 50% of those people who've been arrested have declared bankruptcy over these last few years. And that finding is consistent with my sense of things, which is that many people who are drawn to cults and to conspiracy theories have a chip on their shoulder, which comes from feeling like life hasn't been fair, that they've been screwed, that the system is out to hurt them. Interestingly, you know, Donald Trump was going to drain the swamp and turned out to be the greatest swamp generator of all time. And yet people don't get it, right? I mean, but this notion that he's going to drain the swamp, all of these people behind the scenes, the cabal that's responsible for people's misfortunes, the people and the forces that are responsible for people losing their homes or losing their jobs or whatever, you know, instead of taking responsibility for your own circumstances, it is certainly so much nicer if you can blame somebody else or some forces that you can't quite put your finger on, but which you know are there. All of this is so consistent with so many conspiracies out there.
It gives you that. It gives you a sense of power again, which you've been robbed of, mm-hmm. By bankruptcy, say, and through no intention of your own. But that's just the circumstances. You know.
I was. I just read a really interesting article by a woman who was very involved in QAnon, and she was a lovely person who inspected automobile. Factories. And what happened was she kept going there and there were fewer and fewer jobs and more disenfranchisement. And she just got so upset and sad by what was happening in the manufacturing part of our economy and in her personal life that she really started like, there's got to be a reason for this. Why is this happening? And really got into it. And she talks about neglecting her family. She was a mother of three children. And she just really got into it. And she finally broke away when she started seeing facts and data that contradicted some of her beliefs. I think what we can talk on the individual level, but we really need to talk on the societal level that some of these things that folks are they're feeling it. This is their reality. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it's just so easy to blame this cabal, but it is their reality. So as we talk about solutions, and we really need to know where do we put our attention, right, as a society, as voters, as whatever our political persuasion is, where are we putting our attention? Yeah. Are we putting it on solving these problems? Are we putting it on, you know, and I was thinking, Mark, when you were saying, if the Democrats and the Republicans could just see what each other, mm-hmm. like, here's the people with the great ideas and imagination and exciting thinking. And here's the pragmatic people who know how to make it happen. Okay. If we could just
get them together
work that way, yeah. It would, things would change. And I think that needs to be brought out.
Yeah. Those two extremes are in all our nature, but we have a way of demoting one of them and being too devoted to the other. That you're right, that needs to be changed. That woman that you mentioned probably is unusual in that she allowed some facts in, because they usually don't allow facts in. The other thing is we have to pay attention to is our media. There are ways of isolating yourself from the facts.
Right.
Tune into Fox TV and keep watching Fox TV.
Or the opposite, yeah.
Finding
the news source that reinforces what your beliefs are. The other thing I just wanted to touch on real quickly is somebody mentioned addiction in here, and in that New York Times article Charlie Wurzel wrote, he wrote, where I've become so reliant on the constant stimuli of our connected world that I find myself frequently out of control of my attention. And there have been plenty of studies to show how addicting the internet and, you know, our phone. I mean, just look, you go out anywhere and see people out to dinner and they're on their phones or right. Not out to dinner right now, but you know. So there is this, I think we need to be aware, right, of the addictive quality. And Jonathan, it goes back to, as you're saying in your practice, where you're trying to help people figure out where to focus that attention. It gets harder and harder, doesn't it?
It's brutal. I have a college student right now who was home working remotely. And while he was home and before he was sent off campus like every other student, he was spending 10 hours a day on the internet, either playing video games or doing what a lot of people do now, which is actually to observe other people playing video games. He's now back on campus, feeling really good about the fact that he's actually down to 4 hours a day.
Wow.
Of doing this. And this allows him enough time to actually keep up with his schoolwork. So he's feeling much better about things. And I'm thinking, well, this is great. It's good because hopefully you won't flunk out of school, but 4 hours a day is still a lot of time.
Yeah.
And we as a culture have gotten extremely good at getting people addicted to any number of stimuli. And in fact, what we've seen at the history over the last 20 years of the news business has converted, and this is well documented both for Fox and CNN and so on, both liberal and conservative, is converting the news business into an entertainment business, right?
Absolutely.
And it's all about keeping people entertained. And so the more sensationalistic you can be, the more rapidly you can change from one image to another, the louder you can scream, the more multicolored the images are, the more you will keep people's eyeballs and ears on you.
That's right.
So I think this kind of some advice, maybe going back to one of our previous shows, is we need to get out in nature a little more and leave the devices home, right? Take a walk. Don't take the phone with you.
We need more birding segments.
That's right.
We also need to get the COVID under control so we can do all those things. I mean, right. I think this is another factor that, yeah, if you're going to stuck at home, what are you going to do? Unless you have a zillion hobbies, it's real easy to just plop on your phone and scroll for 2 hours or watch some dumb, little video. So I think, and it's all related, see, conspiracy theory, it's all related. Yeah. But if we could really take seriously getting the COVID under control, I think we're really eager to do a lot more than stare at a screen. I hope.
Yeah, we have about 40 seconds left. Mark, you want a final word?
I guess the bottom message is pay attention to how you pay attention, which is you're so subject to having it, losing control over that. So just watch, go through the day and watch where your attention goes. If you're out in nature, you're going to feel different than you are looking at some action video or action game or action reality TV. Pay attention to where you put your attention, and you'll make some intelligent decisions as opposed to automatic ones.
Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and social worker Ann Gagan, as always, thank you. See you next month. I'm Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.